radical left has taken over the Democratic Party.
Hello and welcome to Think Progressively, covering politics and all the other chaos life has to offer. This is episode 113, recorded on Friday, February 9th from Milwaukee. I'm Joe.
And I'm Jason.
And on today's episode, we delve into the dark depths of American history. But first, the headlines.
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.
Up first in headlines, let's talk about what's really important.
The thrilling GOP primary.
No, I want to talk about the Super Bowl and the Swifty Bowl.
Well, by the time this episode is released, we'll know who won anyway, so this will all be irrelevant. I'm hoping for the 49ers. The Chiefs didn't look as solid this year as they normally have, but in the playoffs, they've played pretty well.
I'm going to argue the famed 49ers defense that has been getting steamrolled by teams who probably don't have the best offenses in the playoffs are going to get destroyed by the Chiefs.
The one thing the 49ers always seem to have is really good linebacker play.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you need to match up with someone like Travis Kelce.
Yeah, I can see that.
So we'll see.
I saw a funny little betting odds thing where someone said, do you believe that Travis Kelce is going to get more or less catches than Taylor Swift has Grammy nominations this year? And that is, I think, above six. So do you believe that?
Catches? Yeah, I think he'll have more than six catches.
All right, mark that down, everybody.
Our prop bet recommendation.
There you go.
My favorite is always the over-under on the national anthem, like how long it takes them.
Or the Gatorade one?
Yeah, what color the Gatorade is at the end.
What do you think the color of a Gatorade is going to be this year?
I always go with yellow. I like I'm an old-fashioned, I like the lemon-lime.
I love lemon-lime, but I don't think it's going to be that. I've learned that we are, I think, in a minority of people who like lemon-lime or the yellow flavor.
It's the original.
I think it's going to be blue. I think blue is too popular. It is overtaken, and there has been this great replacement that has been going on of the yellow Gatorade, and I'm not here for it.
All these blue Gatorades coming in with their families.
But enough of that. Let's talk about the real things. Let's start off with a quick primary update, and boy, will it be quick.
And meaningless.
So, Nevada. Nikki Haley was primed to win the primary in Nevada.
As she was the only one actually running.
But she lost to nobody. And I'm not kidding. None of these candidates, quote unquote, won the Nevada primary with 63% of the vote, trouncing Nikki Haley, I think, by about 30 points. Trump was not actually on the ballot in the primary because he was on the ballot in the Nevada caucus.
Yeah, why did they have both? Thank you.
So long story short is after the 2020 debacle of Iowa's primary, do you remember that?
The Democratic primary in Iowa.
Sorry, not the primary, the Iowa caucuses. There was a huge outcry all over the country about moving away from caucuses and going to primaries. Well, Nevada state government decided to go from caucuses to recognizing primaries for state elections. However, the RNC, who has been trying to rig the GOP primary, even though Trump was the front runner for Donald Trump, told Nevada, nope, we are not going to have a primary. We're going to have a caucus no matter what. Nevada goes back and says, well, it's in our state constitution now to have primaries. We have to have a primary. So the RNC held a separate caucus outside of the state recognized primary, and it was officially declared that it would not recognize the state primary and only the state caucuses, leaving Nevada voters incredibly confused about who to vote for and when. So long story short, it's because the RNC wants to give more chances to Trump, and that's why they chose to keep a caucus even though the state recognized a primary. So Trump was not on the primary ballot, he was on the caucus ballot, which he won handily with about 99% of the vote. And because he only recognizes the caucuses, he took all the delegates from Nevada. But what was interesting about that, though, is Nikki Haley knew she wasn't going to win Nevada in the caucuses, and decided to try to cause confusion to get some headlines, and only register for the primary and not register for the caucus to save some money, thinking that, well, if the headline says Nikki Haley wins the primary, maybe that'll help boost her a little bit for later on in South Carolina.
And she could not defeat
nobody.
None of the above.
I can't. It's so funny. If you want to see how bad the GOP primary electorate is and how in Trump's hands they are, just look at the Nevada primary. There was also a Democratic primary as well, and I just wanted to throw it out there because you still have some people who are trying to say, well, you never know, Joe Biden might not win. He could try to resign and save the country. Dude took 96% of the vote. His main challenger, Dean Phillips, came in third. Not even second, third place with 1.7%, with second going to Marianne Williamson with 2.1%.
Mm-hmm. And again, all the progressives who think that no one's going to vote for Joe Biden, that the protest vote is the only way to go. Where were they?
Don't vote.
Oh, well, I guess then it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, they're really loud, but they don't vote. So the Democrats don't care, which is why I keep trying to tell them to freaking vote. I also thought it was really funny because I'm not sure if you saw this. Dean Phillips tried to spin it by saying how excited he was to break four digits in his vote, which means he broke 1,000 votes.
Right, I got 1,000 votes. In South Carolina.
And still, he plans to keep going in his campaign. Multiple people have asked him.
He's got too much money.
Right. Multiple people have asked him in interviews, so what's the plan? Why are you in this? And he just goes, I'm going to keep going because I'm famous now. I'm relatively somewhat known more than usual. I don't know why we're even trying this charade anymore. Why are we trying to pretend that Joe Biden is not going to be the nominee for the Democrats?
Yes.
For God's sakes, Jason, the Republicans have at least understood that Trump's going to be their guy. They're like, yeah, this guy's crazy. We're going to back him and be crazy too. We got to match that energy, man. We got to go full in on Dark Brandon over here.
Beyond a death or serious illness, the presidential election is between two people, Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
Correct. And while that's going on, Republicans in Congress are doing what they do best, causing chaos. For those of you who haven't heard, there have been a months-long negotiation over the border wall, Israel funding, and Ukraine funding that has been stopped in its tracks thanks to Donald Trump. Senator James Lankford, who Mitch McConnell put in charge of negotiating with the Dems, was completely thrown under the bus when Trump decided to say that we should not try to solve the border crisis.
The border crisis.
During a presidential election year, because he wants to run on it.
And also, it doesn't really exist, but that's another issue.
Right. Even got so bad, man, because the deal was done. Democrats were on board, and it wasn't even a Democrat-friendly bill.
Right. They were giving away everything to Republicans.
Because they know how bad immigration is for Joe Biden right now. They needed a win some way.
It's what the right-wing media and even center media, CNN, MSNBC, has gotten in on it because it's what gets views. It's what sells ads.
Yep.
The crisis at the border, which is not a crisis. The only reason that there is increased activity at the borders is because outlets like Newsmax and Fox and OAN and every other kooky right-wing media outlet has been saying for years that the border is open. Joe Biden is just letting immigrants free across our border, which is of course not true. But when they hear that, what's going to happen? They're going to come here because they hear, well, the border's wide open. Joe Biden is the president and he's just letting immigrants into the United States. So why don't I go to the border and get my entry into the United States, become a citizen and vote? Because that's what they're telling me that I can do on the TV. They're saying I can come in, I get all of the social safety nets that don't exist in the United States. I'll get to vote for Joe Biden because that's the whole reason why I'm being let into the country in the first place, mm-hmm. according to Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity. And they'll put me up in a nice mansion in Kennebunkport or Martha's Vineyard and life will be great. So why wouldn't you come? That's the only reason. Instead, we're having this crisis. If it's a crisis for anyone, it's a crisis for Mexico because that's where all of these camps of people waiting on their immigration status or waiting to go through one of the border crossings, that's where the real problem is. And it's just the standard amount of immigration, both legal and illegal, that we have always had for the last 50 years on our southern border. Nothing has changed. It is not a crisis. It's an imaginary fake boogeyman created by the right, and now even being parroted by the supposed left, and the Republicans still.
Well, let's talk about this because
could not pass this bill.
This was not like some kind of amnesty bill for people. This was straight up border security provisions. Almost $100 billion were going to go to southern border provisions to make it more difficult to cross our border.
They were
going
to build the fucking wall.
Yeah, basically. What association was it? It was like some like Southern Border Patrol Agents Association, like hardcore right-wing Republican association, was in favor of this bill, and Democrats were still going to go for it.
The only thing positive in this bill was more immigration judges to hear cases.
Even worse, because there also were some potential green card benefits and some other like processing benefits as well, which Republicans also hated, which is baffling to me.
They were going to give the president the ability to close the border, which you know is going to get abused instantly.
So calling this an immigration bill is even being a little disingenuous. This is a border security, like border lockdown.
Anti-immigration
bill. Right, absolutely. And even then, Jason, Trump said in one of his recent rallies that this was an open border bill, and people are still believing it.
And he also said that Congress cannot pass this while Joe Biden is president because it would give Joe Biden a political win in an election year.
Well, and I'm glad that you brought it back to that, because Senator Langford has now been very vocal about how he's been thrown under the bus about this thing. And during the vote, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, he made a speech, which I want to play a little clip from here, about how much pressure he's been getting from Republicans for just trying to side with the bill that he negotiated for, that tons of other Republicans love.
Well, first off, I'd like to take issue with your characterization of this clip as short. And second, I would like to take issue with Senator Langford's characterization of the commentator as being popular.
Right.
Because I have never heard of this person before now.
Yeah, that would be right-wing radio host Jesse Kelly, which I've also never heard of. I also like the fact that he kind of just threw in there that lots of Republicans just hated the fact and argued with him over
any
visas?
Immigration
yeah,
at
just,
all?
Just immigration.
Right. It's fine if it comes from certain countries, but definitely not lots of others. We don't need to get into the specifics of why, but let's just not have any immigration at all along the southern border.
But the fact that this guy, who, keep in mind, look, this guy is not a rhino. He is a hard right-wing Republican and always has been. And the fact that he's being cast now as like this liberal nut job who just wants to give Democrats a deal to give Biden the presidency is insane. And the fact that they're trying to tear each other apart about it is even crazier.
So what does the GOP want to do about the border crisis that they invented but don't want to actually pass any immigration legislation to try to resolve? Well, instead, they want to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas. Only the second impeachment of a cabinet secretary in American history.
Well, it must be a really good reason then.
Because there's a border crisis. And they keep saying there's a border crisis. So that must mean that the Homeland Security Secretary is bad. Not that he actually committed an impeachable offense, which is, usually what
high crimes
happen,
and misdemeanors
right.
And whatnot.
He's bad.
Oh.
Because border crisis.
Oh, okay. And how'd that go for them?
It failed. The first time in American history, an impeachment vote in the House failed to pass. The vote failed 216 to 214, although really it was a tie, 215 to 215. We'll get into the details here in a second, with all Democrats, including House member Al Green, who made a like surprise, like WrestleMania style appearance
from the hospital
after having surgery. He literally was wheeled in barefoot.
Yeah.
To cast a vote. The no votes from Republicans, and there were technically four of them. The first was Ken Buck of Colorado, which is kind of surprising because Ken Buck is not very moderate, but I think because Colorado's been changing demographically, he's kind of moved that way. Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, who is kind of known as like a rising star in Republican circles, and he was kind of being groomed for...
He was going to run against Tammy Baldwin this year.
Right, for the Senate seat, and I think that's part of his maneuver here. I think he's trying to appeal more nationally, and obviously voting for this is not a good look for that.
Which I also have to just call out is that now Republicans are calling on him to resign or have someone primary him. Again, from the pool of names of people, we have no idea who they actually are, but I guess are conservative influencers. I don't know. One of those potential people is Alex Brusewitz, who's like this, I had to look it up because I saw a couple couple articles about him on how he's thinking about primarying Gallagher now because of this vote. And like the college Republicans are supporting him and a bunch of like younger, like influential like conservatives are like all supporting him on this. And he's just like a Twitter troll. And that's who's going to.
That's the modern Republican Party.
Yeah, and that's who literally is going to take over running our country.
And then also we had Tom McClintock from California. He's probably been the most vocal person against this vote. He had a speech on the floor. He delivered like a 10-page report about why this was such a bad idea. So no surprise there. You also had Blake Moore of Utah, who initially voted yes and is a yes vote. That's why it was tied initially. Mm-hmm. But he changed his vote to no so that the vote could be taken up again in the future, because it can only be taken up by someone who voted no, and no one else was going to do that. So that's why he changed his vote, so that he could be the person to bring it back up for a vote later on if they somehow get more votes, which I doubt. The Republicans were notably missing Steve Scalise from Louisiana, who was unavailable for the vote as he's undergoing cancer treatment. Couldn't have happened to a better guy. George Santos of New York, who was removed from his seat. Of course, we all remember that. And Kevin McCarthy of California, who retired at the end of last year.
You mean rage quit at the end of last year?
And I believe there are two other Republican seats that are currently open due to special elections that need to be run. So that is why they did not have the votes, even though they control the House.
And even their symbolic gestures just blow up in their faces because they can't get their crap together. That's also crazy to me.
Obviously, God cannot pick a good Speaker of the House. Mike Johnson said he was chosen by God to be the new Moses. God sucks.
Well, let's talk about Mike Johnson, because then after that, because there was Israel funding attached to that, which a lot of Republicans did want.
And you would think the new Moses would get funding for Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. So then Mike Johnson called a vote for a standalone aid bill for Israel, and it failed. It actually failed with a vote of 250 to 180, which sounds like it won, but it didn't, because under the rule that Johnson called it under, it required a special two-thirds vote, which they didn't have, because both Republicans and Democrats voted against the bill. So two fails, two huge fails in one day. And to make things even more fun, RNC Chair Romney McDaniel, who changed her name so that Trump would like her again, is now officially stepping down as RNC Chair, which came after Trump said that she should be replaced during a recent television interview.
I don't think there's anything official, but she did say that she is willing to step down. That's what she told Donald Trump.
Correct.
And she was actually handpicked by Trump for the position of RNC chair. Only the best people, Joe. Once again, yet another.
Well, and here's the thing. In Trump's defense, in Vivek's defense, Ronna McDaniel's been like really crappy at her job. The RNC has been bankrupt. It had the worst fiscal year, I think, in the last several decades.
Because everyone's giving to Trump's scam fundraising organizations.
That's the best part.
And all the money's going to pay Stormy Daniels and E. Jean Carroll.
That's my favorite part about this, is you have Donald Trump calling for Ronna McDaniel to resign, as well as many other Trump acolytes calling for her to resign. But none of them will admit that the person who's calling for Ronna to resign is the problem with the party. Ugh. God. Well, most likely, again, like Jason said, there is nothing official, but most likely from what we can tell, Ronna will leave after the South Carolina primary, and Trump recently recommended North Carolina GOP chair Michael Whately, who is a hardcore Trump loyalist and another big lie conspiracy giver, I guess you can say.
Theorist.
Stop the proponent. Steal guy. Yeah. So cool. We're going to get even crazier up in this.
M&M's will not be satisfied until every last cartoon character is deeply unappealing and totally androgynous, until the moment you wouldn't want to have a drink with any one of them. That's the goal. When you're totally turned off, they've won.
Boy, ain't right.
For our Fox in the Head tonight, we have something a little bit different for you. It's not something on Fox News. It's not something that you see on the Daily Wire. It's not Matt Walsh. It's not Charlie Kirk. It's Representative Tom Cotton during an actual congressional hearing. And I'm losing my mind that this was during an actual congressional hearing. Did you see this beforehand?
I'm vaguely aware of it. I may have seen. I don't remember what I've actually seen in video from this. I knew it happened. I saw a piece of it. I don't really remember if I know how much of this I know of.
Well, for a little bit of context, there was a recent joint public hearing about social media impacts on Americans. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook was there. Yakarino of Twitter or X was there. And Xu Zichu of TikTok was also in attendance for questioning. Of course, Republicans acted erratic and disorganized throughout the entire hearing. Ted Cruz was there and he was having a wonderful time. Josh Hawley was being Josh Hawley. But things got super racist when focus ever turned to Chu because he's Asian and the others were white. And especially, it got really racist when it was Tom Cotton's turn. So let's take a listen.
You said today, as you often say, that you live in Singapore. Of what nation are you a citizen?
Singapore.
Are you a citizen of any other nation?
No, Senator.
Have you ever applied for Chinese citizenship?
Senator, I serve my nation in Singapore. I did not.
Do you have a Singaporean passport?
Yes, and I served my military for two and a half years in Singapore.
Do you have any other passports from any other nations?
No, Senator.
Your wife is an American citizen. Your children are American citizens.
That's correct.
Have you ever applied for American citizenship?
Not yet.
Okay. Have you ever been a member of the Chinese Communist Party?
Senator, I'm Singaporean. No.
Have you ever been associated or affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party?
No, Senator. Again, okay. I'm Singaporean.
Let me ask you some hopefully simple questions. You said earlier, in response to a question, that what happened at Tiananmen Square in June of 1989 was a massive protest. Did anything else happen in Tiananmen Square?
Yes, I think it's well documented. There was a massacre.
There was the indiscriminate slaughter of hundreds or thousands of Chinese citizens.
Are you Chinese?
This is straight out of, like, McCarthyism.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh.
This is the worst aspect of America writ large in this hearing. One, not understanding the world makeup and, like, the fact that someone from Singapore is not going to think that they're from China. China might argue that people from Singapore are actually Chinese citizens. But, yeah, just a ignorance, a very combative form of racism.
I love the pause in it where it's like, have you ever applied for Chinese citizenship? No, I'm from Singapore. Well, your kid and your wife are U.S. citizens. Are you ever applied to U.S. citizenship? No, not yet. Are you a member of the Communist Party? It's like, what?
Are you now? Have you ever been?
Oh my God.
So if the head of TikTok has to answer questions about Tiananmen Square massacre, should anyone who's American, like Mark Zuckerberg, like Lindy Yaccarino, they should be asked about all of the terrible moments in American history too, right? As we will
be very much
getting into later in this episode. Yeah, that is just absolutely ridiculous and so out of context.
Well, it's hilarious because they're trying to do this whole, like, oh God, what is it? The whole, like, Dark Soldier type of thing where, like, they're going to secretly break his brain by trying to ask what questions. I can't. I'm just gonna sort.
He's a Manchurian candidate.
Thank you. I couldn't think of the damn thing. But yes, like, it's so racist and ridiculous. So then he goes on, though, and kind of then accuses Chu of being afraid of being, I'm not kidding, disappeared for not answering the questions correctly.
Let me ask you this. Joe Biden last year said that Xi Jinping was a dictator. Do you agree with Joe Biden? Is Xi Jinping a dictator?
Senator, I'm not going to comment on any world leaders.
What? Why won't you answer these very simple questions?
Senator, it's not appropriate for me scared? As a businessman to comment on world leaders.
Are you scared that you'll lose your job if you say anything negative about the Chinese Communist Party?
I disagree that. You will find content that is critical of China on our platform.
The next time you go on, are you scared that you'll be arrested and disappear the next time you go to mainland China?
Senator, you will find content that's critical of China and any other country freely on TikTok.
Okay.
Why, as a businessman of a multi-billion-dollar company which does business in China, won't you say anything negative about the president of China, sir? I wonder why.
What are we doing here, man? Like, this is insane. This is in a public hearing. Ugh. And then Khan goes into full-on conspiracy mode by accusing Biden and Democrats of secretly helping TikTok for reasons.
Are you familiar with the name Christina Cafara?
You may have to give me more details.
Christina Cafara was a paid advisor to ByteDance, your communist-influenced parent company. She was then hired by the Biden FTC to advise on how to sue Mr. Zuckerberg's company.
Senator, ByteDance is a global company and not a Chinese Communist company. It's owned by global investors.
Public reports indicate that your lobbyists visited the White House more than 40 times in 2022. How many times did your company visit, did your company's lobbyists visit the White House last year?
I don't know that, Senator.
Are you aware that the Biden campaign and the Democratic National Committee is on your platform? They have TikTok accounts?
Senator, we encourage people to come on to create organic,
authentic
content.
They won't let their staffers use their personal phones. They give them separate phones that they only use TikTok on.
We encourage everyone to join, including yourself, Senator.
So all these companies are being sued by the FTC. You're not. The FTC has a former paid advisor, your parent, talking about how they can sue Mr. Zuckerberg's company. Joe Biden's reelection campaign, the Democratic National Committee, is on your platform. Let me ask you, have you or anyone else at TikTok communicated with or coordinated with the Biden administration, the Biden campaign, or the Democratic National Committee to influence the flow of information on your platform?
We work with anyone, any creators who want to use our campaign. It's all the same process
okay,
that we have.
So what we have here, we have a company that's a tool of the Chinese Communist Party that is poisoning the minds of America's children, in some cases driving them to suicide, and that at best the Biden administration is taking a pass on, at worst maybe in collaboration with. Thank you, Mr. Chu.
Good day, Mr. Chu.
Really stretching very, very hard for that.
I just, because there was once an advisor for ByteDance who, Chu is correct, is a global company, not just some random Chinese conglomerate. And then also the Biden administration hired her to do a report for something else. Therefore, they're in cahoots with the Chinese Communist Party. And because the DNC is on TikTok because of campaign purposes, they're somehow promoting themselves through communist algorithms. What the fuck is going on?
I don't know. I'm with Tom Cotton here. Let's get rid of all corporate lobbyists in Washington.
I'm okay with that.
Bravo, Mr. Cotton. Let's do this thing.
Okay. Which was not how I was expecting to end this segment, but fine. Bravo, Representative Cotton. You've done
gotten to the real heart of the matter. Let's get money out of politics.
You've done your country well today.
Yes. Get rid of corporate lobbyists. They're terrible for this country.
Oh, what an idiot.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it? It's hard to get any word in with this clown.
Okay, for our main topic today, this is going to be in honor of Black History Month. I loved the ones that we did last year in February. I encourage everyone, if you like this episode, go see those. We did some similar ones. We did the whitewashing of Martin Luther King. We did the story of Henrietta Lacks. Great stuff. There is going to be some really tough subjects. We're going to be talking about a lot of violence, a lot of hate. If that's not what you want to hear, I would advise skipping this episode. It's not going to be a fun one.
But it will be informative.
And these are all stories that are mostly unknown, that we've got two from Florida that both came up during the Ron DeSantis attempt to change the curriculum standards in Florida and talk about how there was violence on both sides in these massacres. It's where I became aware of them. And the first one that we have for you is going to be Ocoee, the Ocoee massacre in Ocoee, Florida, and it started on November 1st, 1920. One day before the election, it was a nationwide, it was a presidential election year in 1920. So one day before that election, and this is the first election that women are allowed to vote in, by the way, presidential election, the Ku Klux Klan marched through the black neighborhoods of Ocoee, Florida, which is a small town in Orange County just west of Orlando, mostly full of citrus orchards, and proclaimed that blacks would not be allowed to vote the next day, and that there would be severe consequences for any that tried. The next day, when black residents did attempt to vote, none were allowed inside the polling locations. They were told by white poll workers that their names somehow could not be found on the registries, and told to leave by Klan members stationed outside. There was also a story of one area where they were told that they had to get paperwork notarized by the notary public in the area before they could be allowed to vote. And that guy was like out of town.
Oh, of course.
So yeah, definitely organized attempts to disenfranchise black voters.
factors.
One resident, Moses Norman, who was a successful citrus farmer and prominent member of the black community in Ocoee, he helped organize voter registration drives in the area, who, after being turned away from his polling place, went to see John Cheney, who is a former federal judge and voting rights activist who lived in Orlando. He also helped organize voter registration for black residents. He was actually born in Milwaukee, Joe, a local connection.
Interesting.
Cheney counseled Norman to return to Ocoee and once again attempt to vote and to record the names of anyone who denied him, along with the names of anyone else who was turned away, for a future lawsuit. Norman returned to the polling place, possibly armed. Accounts differ. He probably should have been, knowing the story, and was again denied entry. The official reason given was that he did not pay his poll tax. That's what was reported. Huh? The poll tax was instituted at this time in Florida. So, like, if you read newspaper accounts at the time, they almost all state that these uppity Negroes came to the polling place to vote, but they hadn't paid their poll tax, so they were turned away by righteous white poll workers, and then they caused violence.
That's law and order, right?
Yeah, the official story. But that is very unlikely, both given Norman's wealth and, like I said, his history with voter registration drives, where he was openly offering to pay the poll tax for anyone who could not afford it. So very unlikely that he could not or did not pay his poll tax. A fight broke out, and Norman was thought to have taken refuge at another prominent black businessman and citrus farmer's home, Julius July Perry. So fight breaks out. Mose Norman leaves, goes to the home of July Perry. A mob formed, which included former Orlando police chief Colonel, and I don't know if that's like an army colonel or if it's like Colonel Sanders colonel.
I mean, if you see his name, I'd go with the latter.
Sam Salisbury. They were deputized by Orange County Sheriff Deputy Clyde Pounds and went to arrest Perry and Norman. The mob surrounded Perry's home and a gunfight ensued. A lot of conflicting accounts on exactly what happened. I've heard that potentially no one fired from inside the home. We know that two members of the mob were killed and Perry was severely wounded. There's some theories that the two that were killed as part of the mob were actually killed by other members of the mob. It really, at that point, I don't think it matters. Anyone who was killed, that's at worst self-defense. They're surrounding and attacking this guy's home.
Right.
Perry's wife, Estella, and his daughter, Caretha, who had been shot in the arm, fled, possibly along with Norman, who is not seen again after this. He could have never even gone to Perry's home. That's just what everyone assumed, and that's why the mob went there. But he seems to have just completely vanished after this. July Perry was taken by the mob and dragged behind a truck to Orlando while his home was burned. Again, accounts differ exactly the order of events, if he was even taken to the jail, if he was taken to a hospital, but he was possibly held in the Orlando jail briefly before being hanged and riddled with bullets near Judge Cheney's home as a message and warning about organizing black voters. And I wanted to read a letter that was sent to John Cheney by members of the Ku Klux Klan on September 29th, so leading up to this election, because he has been working to register black voters and organize the vote.
Sir, while stopping in your beautiful little city this week, I was informed that you are in the habit of going out among the Negroes of Orlando and delivering lectures, explaining to them just how to become citizens and how to assert their rights.
You can just imagine the disdain when he's like thinking of that phrase, where it's like, ugh, you're teaching them to become citizens.
If you are familiar with the history of the days of Reconstruction, which followed in the wake of the Civil War, you will recall that the scallywags of the North and the Republicans of the South proceeded very much the same as you are proceeding, to instill into the Negro the idea of social equality. You will also remember these things forced the loyal citizens of the South to organize clans of determined men who pledged themselves to maintain white supremacy and to safeguard our women and children. And now, if you are a scholar, you know that history repeats itself, and that he who resorts to your kind of game is handling edge tools. We will always enjoy white supremacy in this country, and he who interferes must face the consequences.
It's good to know that they also used all caps back in 1920.
Yeah. White supremacy. Signed, Grandmaster Florida Ku Klux. So that is basically the lynching of July Perry, and hanging his body near Cheney's home is like the postscript to that letter. But the bloodlust of the white mob was not yet slated, and they proceeded to burn and loot black homes and businesses in Ocoee and murdered black residents they encountered along the way. Historians estimate 25 black homes, 2 churches, and a lodge were burned down. The number of deaths in the massacre is unknown, with estimates ranging from 30 to 80, because as we have seen with similar stories, and we will continue to see in this episode, there is little care taken by white officials to document black victims, most of which end up in a mass unmarked grave.
Right.
Estella and Coretha, July's wife and daughter, were captured and held for 27 days under the threat of their own lynching, and were eventually left homeless in Tampa.
Just for association, or?
Because they were in the home where supposedly, you know, these two righteous white members of this lynch mob were murdered. I believe they were originally held on murder charges, and obviously they weren't going to make those stick, so after 27 days, and the lynch mob actually demanding for them to be released and being denied by the sheriff, they were let go and free, you know, no harm, no foul, go, you've lost everything you've ever owned. You had a successful business and home and no more. Every single black resident of the city of Ocoee was driven out within the next year, forced to sell or abandon their businesses, land, and homes. There were around 300 black residents prior, according to census data. Ocoee became a sundown town and was avoided by black Floridians for generations. Black families did not begin moving back until the 1980s. There were many stories that I listened to in doing research for this that were people talking about, yeah, we never went to Ocoee. We would always avoid it. I never knew why. No one would ever say, but I just knew black people did not go to that city.
So the fear basically passed down generation after generation.
Yeah, people didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
It was, again, like always these stories, it's something that was mostly forgotten, like the reason why, but the fear of ever going back was still there for 60 years. So to me, we talked about earlier in this episode in the headlines, this shows you how important voting is. It is really and truly a right that people have fought and died over. The reason this happened is because white residents did not want black voters to exercise the little power that they had. And that power was encapsulated in their vote. And like we talked about earlier, when people just throw that away, it's really infuriating. And also, it highlights the fragility of black wealth throughout American history. When you look at stories like Tulsa, Greenwood, we'll talk about Rosewood in a minute here.
Wilmington.
For 100 years after slavery, black Americans have repeatedly lost everything that they built in the blink of an eye. And for many, their lives included, because of angry, racist white mobs. And it's a story that you could tell all day. We're going to get to 3 stories here today. It's a drop in the bucket. Every time I learn about one, I see 3 more that I didn't know. And they are all mostly forgotten or ignored today. And that is a shame.
You know, and I think that's something, I mean, we've talked about this before. I know we talked about it last year as well, but this is where it's so important to talk about and stand up against some of these anti-DEI CRT movements, because this is the kind of history they're trying to erase. And I'm going to be completely honest. I'm sure a lot of those people who are in those movements don't even know these stories even exist, right? They are completely ignorant about what happened in their own country. And man, I don't know if it's like woke to just learn about their own history at the end of the day. Like, what are we doing here? Like, this is just one of the three stories that we have today, and this was already bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely agree with you too, because I'm happy that we're doing this now, because I have the same experience where every time we try to do research for these types of stories, more and more things come up and you're like, holy crap, I never even learned about this before, but it's so prevalent and common.
Mm-hmm. So we'll keep going with another Florida race massacre. Again, we learned, thanks to Ron DeSantis's efforts to silence this type of history, the Rosewood Massacre. On January 1st, 1923, a 22-year-old married white woman in Sumner, Florida, Fanny Taylor, was found by her neighbor, bruised and battered. Taylor claimed that she had been assaulted by a black man who had entered her home. Sarah Carrier and her granddaughter Philomena Goines, who were heading to Taylor's home to do laundry, stated that they saw a white man leaving the home earlier. It's pretty widely believed, and I think very likely, that Taylor was having an affair and got into an altercation with her lover, who then beat her, and to cover it up, she claimed it was just a random black man who had entered her home and assaulted her for no particular reason. And it was just assault originally.
Yeah, that's kind of the key with this story, isn't it?
Taylor's husband, James, a local mill foreman, began gathering a mob, including many members of the KKK, who had just finished marching in a large New Year's Eve parade in Gainesville the previous day.
Against who?
It was just a town parade for the KKK on New Year's Eve.
Okay.
The assault, and there's actually pictures you can look online, you can find. There's images from that parade. The assault accusation quickly somehow turned into a rape accusation, and a black prisoner escape from a chain gang nearby gave the growing white mob a target, Jesse Hunter. You have a woman who claimed that she was assaulted by a black man, and everyone just changed it to rape, I guess, even though she told the sheriff she was not raped. You had a black prisoner escape from a chain gang. That must be the guy. That's who they're looking for. The mob, now over 200, began heading toward Rosewood, a mostly black town where they believed Hunter is being hidden by the residents there. There's, again, a lot of different accounts. Some say they had a dog that he was following the scent of this person. I don't know if I believe that. Along the way, they attack any black men they find, starting with Aaron Carrier, Sarah's nephew, who is then kidnapped by the mob and dragged by car back to Sumner. The Levi County Sheriff Robert Elias Walker, thankfully, placed him under protective custody and moved him to Gainesville. The mob was then led by dogs to the home of Sam Carter, a blacksmith and Masonic Lodge member. Most of the stories say that Taylor's white lover, like even the ones that are like, okay, she was definitely lying and she was having an affair with this guy, say that he fled to Rosewood and he was a Masonic member too, and he found Carter and convinced him to help him get out of town. I don't think I believe that, honestly. I feel like that's a little contrived. I think it was just a way, that story is just a way to reconcile the fact that Sam Carter was tortured by the mob and then admitted to helping the person, the assaulter that they were looking for, escape. I just think it was, he just said whatever that they wanted him to hear.
Sure.
Because he was being tortured by a mob. You'll say anything. Again, torture does not work. So I think people try to, like, well, he must have been telling the truth, so how could this be true? And they kind of try to fit everything together. I think maybe they had dogs with them. This is just a random mob. They probably had, like, hunting dogs with them.
I'm sure.
All of this was just fit together. But after his confession, he was supposed to lead the mob to where Hunter was, and he just basically led them out into the woods. And when they couldn't find anybody, they shot Carter in the face and hung him from a tree. On January 4th, The mob surrounded the Carrier's home, believing that Sylvester Carrier, a respected leader of Rosewood and Sarah's son, was harboring Jesse Hunter, who, by the way, is never found in any of this.
Is there a reason why they think?
He is a prominent member of the community. That's who somebody would go to. And that, there was also, I guess, some resentment because Sylvester basically didn't take any shit from, you know, the white people in town.
Sure.
And I think that was part of it as well.
It's just fascinating about how much of this just keeps going with a lot of these stories, just based on the loosest of logic.
It's all nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, Tulsa was the same way. It was another false accusation of like, oh, he stepped on my foot or something.
Yeah.
And that turned into, again, like sexual assault and burned down the whole town. It's constantly the way these stories go. Sylvester is Sarah's son, as I said. So she is in the home as well. A firefight breaks out between the white thugs and the Carrier family, mortally wounding both Sylvester and Sarah, and unfortunately leaving two dead racist white bags of trash on their lawn. News of the violence spreads and is even covered in local newspapers as a race war.
Oh yeah, there it is.
This draws in even more angry whites looking for an excuse to kill blacks. On January 5th, the reinforced terrorist gang now returned to Rosewood and began burning homes and businesses and killing black residents. James Carrier, who was hiding in a nearby swamp, came out to bury his brother Sylvester and his mother Sarah. He was found by the mob, forced to dig his own grave, and lynched. Once again,
Jesus.
That's what this episode is going to be. Once again, estimates vary wildly, but somewhere around 30 to 80 Rosewood residents are killed. Every building in Rosewood is burned down, save one single home, and survivors are left to flee everything they owned, never to return. Small silver lining for our race? Some were helped to evacuate by white allies. General store owner John Wright and his wife Mary Jo, who, that was the one home that didn't burn down. They didn't burn down the white general store owner's home. But to his credit, he used the one home that was standing to hide refugees from this massacre. And a pair of brothers, John and William Bryce, brought a train through Rosewood. They were train engineers and helped residents escape in the freezing temperatures on January 6th. Now, post massacre, in February, an all-white grand jury convened in Bronson. Over several days, they heard 25 witnesses, 8 of whom were black, but found insufficient evidence to prosecute anyone for the slaughter.
Oh, of course, because why not?
It's just something that happened.
Boys will be boys.
In the wake of the Rosewood massacre, the once prosperous town is now completely gone, and it took less than a week, all because of a lie. This story was almost completely forgotten until 1982, when investigative reporter Gary Moore wrote a story that was picked up, I think, by multiple papers, including the Tampa Bay Times. I believe he was a writer for the St. Petersburg Times. And this would be the first detailed account of the Rosewood Massacre ever released to the public.
Can you imagine that? 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just this town that was there 1 week. And gone the next. And no one talks about it. It's just, you look at the census data, and it was like, oh, there used to be a town here. And also, even like the neighboring area, the black population just drops off for no apparent reason. That's actually like how this story came out, was Gary Moore looking through all of this and talking to people in the area, and them kind of eventually saying their story. And I think one of the main people was in the very beginning of this, when we talked about Sarah Carrier's granddaughter, Philomena Goines. It was her son that started telling the story, and she was very angry about it. She maintained that it was all a lie throughout the whole process, and I believe they had psychologists who, this was like a big thing on like 60 Minutes, I believe it was.
Okay.
And they talked to psychologists because it was like, we now have found all of this evidence, and you know, by looking through this, we know it happened. Why does this person who was very heavily involved say none of it ever happened? And they basically said it's because of PTSD, because of the trauma and the desire to not have it happen again. She's got to, you know, appease the white folks. Like, oh, they didn't do anything.
Well, if you make too much noise,
They'll come and take everything again.
Yeah. Holy crap, man.
So because that story was published and started to gain attention and people started talking about it again, in 1993, a lawsuit was filed on behalf of the Rosewood survivors against the state government for its failure to protect them and their families. And kind of the rationale behind that is this wasn't just an isolated incident that happened and was over rather quickly. This took a week.
Yeah.
So why did the government never do anything to try to protect? Residents of Rosewood were just massacred over an extended period of time. The entire city was burned down. Why was nothing done to protect them? And this culminated in a $2.1 million bill passed by the Florida legislature, setting aside $1.5 million to the survivors and their families, a $500,000 pool for property damage claims, and a $100,000 scholarship, which still exists to this day. I believe this is the only incident of reparations being paid to African-American victims of white violence in America. It shouldn't be. Something that I found interesting about this story is the supposed desire of these racist bigots to protect white women from the savage lusts of the black man. It was even reported in the Florida Times Union that the KKK members in that parade in Gainesville that we talked about had a banner reading, "First and always protect womanhood." That it really reminds me of the trans bigots that we have now.
Who use the literally same rhetoric.
The exact same rhetoric to insulate their hate from criticism when they talk about trans rights and protecting women in sports.
But you see that a lot, though, in these types of moral panics. It's the exact same thing we also saw during the heat of like the same-sex marriage debate, where it was all about protecting the sanctity of marriage, protecting heterosexual couples and things like that, where people will try to frame the maintaining of the status quo and maintaining social hierarchies as a way of protecting supposedly like weak institutions and things that we are supposed to be valuing, even though they don't at all. Because let's also be real here. None of these people back in the 1920s and even today do not give a rip about women. Like, that's a big
right.
part about
yeah,
this.
Exactly. The same people that beat their wives at home.
Right. Are also going around saying we need to protect women.
Mm-hmm.
Or say women's
right, because it's just a cover for their own racism.
Yeah, or sexism or whatever it is.
Right.
All right, two down, one more.
Last one, we will skip a little bit ahead chronologically and move out of Florida to the Columbia, Tennessee race riots of 1946. On February 25th, 1946, Gladys Stevenson took her son James, a recently returned World War II Navy veteran, to the department store Castor Knot, where she had been having problems retrieving her radio that she had left there for service. Much like a lot of these other stories, there are 100 different accounts of exactly what happened, but trying to just get the big points out, it's pretty clear Gladys got into a heated argument with store clerk Billy Fleming. Some accounts are that he had sold her radio to someone else, maybe even his own father, that he had quoted her one price and told her another price when she came to pick it up, that she had gone there multiple times. I don't think it's really all that important, but basically she gets into an argument with the store clerk. Some accounts say that he slaps her and then her son jumps in. Again, not really clear, but in one account, Fleming followed the Stevensons towards the door and punched James in the back of the head. James Stevenson was not only a Navy veteran, but he was a welterweight boxer in the Navy. And again, all of the other parts may be right, may be wrong, but what's clear is that James knocked Fleming through the plate glass window of the store to the sidewalk outside. The two continued fighting, and a crowd quickly gathered, a white crowd, of course, attacking both James and Gladys, who were subsequently arrested and fined $50 for breach of peace.
Do you know if Lovecraft, have you ever seen Lovecraft Country?
Yes.
Do you know if like that one of those early scenes in Lovecraft Country was actually inspired by this story? Because this sounds like very familiar.
I don't recall that.
So because at least the way you wrote it, it makes it sound very familiar to like an early scene, like in the first episode.
Well, certainly a lot of themes of racism and the history of sundown towns and the Green Book and all that are all in there. So I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, it's been a while. I watched it when it first was
right,
on the
air. Right, it was a while
ago. Yeah.
So but so it triggered the memory for me. And
Yep. I was disappointed when it got canceled. I wanted a season two, but now with Jonathan Majors and all those issues, it wasn't going to happen either way. So
anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, back to the story.
Back to this super great story that is not going to make me really upset and depressed.
Gladys was released from police custody, but James, again, accounts differ. Either he was held or he was released and then rearrested after Billy's father demanded that he be charged with attempted murder. An angry white mob, gee, you haven't said that enough in this episode, began gathering in the town square and asking for Stevenson to be released to them by the sheriff, obviously, so that they could lynch him. And I have a little side note in here. Columbia has had 5 documented lynchings in the 20th century. In 1924, a black man was shot and killed in the courthouse after his sentence was commuted by the brother of his victim. If his sentence was commuted, I'm not sure if that's accurate, but that's what it says. In 1927, Henry Choate was being held as a suspect when he was lynched and was hanged from the courthouse. If that sounds familiar at all to you, Joe, I don't know if that's ringing bells.
Ugh.
This is the same Columbia, Tennessee courthouse that was the backdrop to the music video for Jason Aldean's racist pro-lynching anthem, Try That in a Small Town, which we reluctantly covered in episode 97. And that is where we originally encountered this story and why it made it on our topics list.
Right.
In 1933, Cordy Cheek, a 17-year-old, was accused of raping a white girl. After a grand jury declined to indict him for lack of evidence, he was abducted from Nashville by white men, including law officials, I believe it was a magistrate involved, and taken back to Columbia. There he was castrated and lynched by a white mob.
Holy shit.
So this area obviously has a long and storied history of lynching, and that is what this white mob is looking to continue. They are demanding that the sheriff release Stevenson. They are going to lynch him. James was instead released to local black businessman James Blair, who posted his bond. This, as you can imagine, angered the white mob, which continued to grow, and talk began circulating of going into the black business district known as the Mink Slide, or I saw other accounts that said it was known as the Bottom.
Okay.
Mink Slide sounds neater to me, and starting buildings on fire, because that's apparently what we do.
Yeah, I guess.
The black residents, many of whom were recently returned veterans, began arming themselves and preparing to defend their neighborhood. Someone had the idea to shoot out the streetlights to help defenders conceal themselves in the darkness. 4 police officers responded to the gunfire and entered the area over the shouted protests for them to stay away. The officers were all wounded by gunfire, but survived. Local and state police, along with the state guard, surrounded the neighborhood. And now again, here's where there are some different accounts. From what I can tell, the military, the state guard, were mostly a positive force here. They tried to keep residents away from the armory, and they basically just tried to keep everyone from going into the Mink Slide area. And it was mostly the state patrol who were going, like, they went in early, according to one account that I read, against the orders that they were given, and began looting businesses and confiscating weapons without warrants. Ultimately, over 100 black residents were arrested without being charged with a crime or given legal counsel. And I'm ending on this story, by the way, because out of all of them, this is like the least bad story. So we kind of, you know, get to end on somewhat of a positive note, I guess. On February 28th, during questioning about the shooting of the policeman, three suspects, James Johnson, William Gordon, and Napoleon Stewart, somehow allegedly were able to acquire guns, and both Johnson and Gordon were killed. This is another one where I do not believe the official account. Supposedly, there's two different accounts that I saw, they either wrestled guns away from the police officers. Now, they're being questioned for attempted murder of four police white police officers. These are all black men. They're not restrained, handcuffed in any way during this questioning. I don't believe that at all. They're able to wrestle the guns away from the officers. The other account I heard said that they made it into like the armory in the police station. And that's how they acquired guns. But they were basically executed by police in the police station. Another prisoner was injured. I believe Napoleon Stewart was not injured in this incident. So you now have two dead black men and another wounded by police in the police station, and a really suspicious story. These events garnered national attention, and the NAACP sent the director counsel of their legal defense, Thurgood Marshall, who should again ring a few bells, who joined local attorneys Z. Alexander Luby and Maurice Weaver on the defense team. 25 black men were charged with the attempted murder of the four policemen at trial. All but two of them were acquitted. Charges were later dropped against the remaining two, assuming that their convictions would be overturned on appeal. So, big win. That is actually a positive. It's unfortunate that two people died in this farce of a maneuver, but in all of the other stories we have had, even going back to the ones we covered last year, this is the best overall outcome. The city was not burned to the ground.
Right.
Which is, I think, the first one of all of these that didn't. After the defense lawyers were leaving the courthouse in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, where the trial had been relocated. And it's important to kind of note the geography, because Lawrenceburg is southwest of Columbia, and Nashville, which is, you know, the major city in the area, is northeast of Columbia. So pretty much the lawyers are going to go to Nashville from Lawrenceburg, where they're leaving, and they have to basically drive past Columbia on their way.
Okay.
After they were leaving the courthouse in Lawrenceburg, they were pulled over three times by police, culminating in the arrest of Thurgood Marshall on suspicion of drunk driving.
Oh, okay.
Luby was told to leave the area by the police, but he refused, basically assuming, and so did Thurgood Marshall. He told this story. There's a few records of it. The police were going to lynch future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. But Luby continued to follow the police car. Eventually, Marshall was taken to a magistrate in Columbia. So the police were from Columbia, who released the obviously sober attorney. Marshall then made his way to the Mink Slide neighborhood, where he told residents what was going on, and they then escorted him out of town using multiple vehicles as decoys.
Holy crap.
So the first black Supreme Court justice in the United States history was very nearly lynched for winning a court case in the 1940s. Racism is just the thing that happened in the past. You know?
Once slavery was done.
Yeah, everything was equal. So I think this story is important because it shows the roots of the growing civil rights movement in America. You have black veterans returning home after fighting for freedom in Europe and the Pacific, fighting for the freedom of the world, liberating France, freeing Europeans, only to return home to Jim Crow segregation and second-class citizenship.
And I think like a lot of people hear that in particular, where it's like, oh, a lot of, you know, people of color, you know, fought for this country and they came back and they didn't have any good treatment. You know, there was still segregation and it was pretty bad, but they were never told exactly what happened. And actually, I really like, this isn't black history per se, but it makes me think about the later chapters of that one book read, The Emperor Was Divine, where you had the post-World War II stuff and how these people were like coming home from just brutal
being
horrible,
enslaved by their own government,
to just being treated horribly by their fellow communities. And I don't think our history classes hit that home of how bad it was. Granted, again, maybe I'm just focused on too much, but I don't know how you could actually portray that well to a bunch of kids like in middle school and potentially even high school. But
I grew up hearing stories about how terrible it was, and they're kind of dubious stories, honestly, but it did happen in some instances of Vietnam veterans coming home and being spit on and called baby killer, and how terrible that was. I didn't hear any stories about World War II veterans coming home and being lynched in the streets.
Yeah, I agree.
And it did show that, yeah, you can fight back. They saved these people that took arms and shot at police. They saved their city, their neighborhood, from being burned to the ground. So I think that is an important lesson. And, you know, you'd like to think that of all these stories we listen to today, that things like that can't happen today. You know, we've somehow evolved past this history of human tribalism. But really, how can we know that? I think January 6th showed us that violent white mobs being driven mad with a lie are still very much a reality in today's world.
Well, and actually, I'd go even further saying, you know, how can we know that it's not like that today? I would argue we do know that it is like that today. So it's almost the exact opposite because of one, January 6th, I think it's a good example of that. We already talked about the rise of moral panics and conspiracism, especially on the right, and how that's all dealing with different types of moral panics of minority identities. I mean, I'm still thinking back to, do you remember when we covered, God, was it like 2 years ago or something like that, about the violence over school boards?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that violence was about CRT and trans students. And you had people getting arrested because they're getting
fights breaking out.
Because they're getting super violent over letting trans kids just be who they were. So I'd argue almost the exact opposite, which is we know that we are like this today, because it's showing us over and over and over again.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder, when you hear some people say, make America great again,
what exactly do they mean?
Yeah, do they mean this America, where black businesses and homes are burnt down and people are lynched for nothing? Is this the greatness of America that they're talking about?
Well, and I would, to try to even steel man that, I would even argue that a lot of people who say that aren't arguing for that specifically. I think we can agree on that. But the feeling is definitely there, if that makes sense. The desire to have those social hierarchies where if you see people of color thriving, you will see that as a threat to yourself and to your community, and you need to do something about it. And
then you'll write a letter to a judge saying that you'll defend white supremacy.
In all caps.
Yes. So, I mean, obviously, I've said it before, kill whitey.
Oh, God.
But what else can we do? Well, today, earlier today, and I know we've talked about this, we still have not made the trip.
Because we suck.
When we originally started talking about this, they were closed, planning on reopening, but they are reopened now. In our own hometown, Milwaukee has the American Black Holocaust Museum. We need to go down there. We always say we're going to, so I'm making a commitment. Well, we have to the next time, instead of bowling or going out to dinner together or all the other fun, romantic things that we do, we need to go to the American Black Holocaust Museum. Earlier today, after doing all the research for this episode and being depressed about it and what can I do to help, I became a member of the Black Holocaust Museum.
Nice.
So now we have to go.
Okay.
And I'll leave the link in the show notes for everyone else. You can donate. It is a virtual museum as well. Even if you don't live in the area, you can visit their virtual exhibits. You can donate to them. That is the story that we've been telling, the history of Holocaust in America against Black Americans.
Well, and specifically against Black success.
Well, that is usually the target.
And if I just had to end on anything, it'd be, number one, definitely donate to that because it's a fantastic organization.
Definitely kill whitey.
But number two is tell people about these stories, especially tell white people about these stories. And I mean, without trying to like plug our own selves, but like share this podcast, share other podcasts and other resources. We'll include more resources about these exact same stories in our show notes if you want to do more reading about it as well.
There is a movie, a John Singleton directed movie about Rosewood. I believe it is just called Rosewood. It came out in 1997, starring Ving Rhames and Don Don Cheadle. I haven't watched it, but it seems good. A good director, good cast.
So just make sure you share this and tell people about these things, because that's what's going to help the most, is just informing people who have no clue that this stuff exists and that this is part of our American history that lots of people who are uninformed about our history are trying to erase.
Kill Whitey.
Thank you for listening. We hope to see you in the next episode. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at ThinkProPod. You can email us at thinkpropod@gmail.com. And remember, when in doubt, think progressively.
And hastily, right before you came, reassemble the studio here in the basement, since we were climate refugees last week, banished to the upstairs, the cramped quarters due to the melting snow and the sump pump running.
Well, I appreciate you doing so.
Yeah, it is. I hope everything's hooked up correctly, because I literally just threw it together in 10 minutes. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I was going to assemble it earlier, but then it was storming last night. I'm like, man, if we get a lot of rain, probably gonna kick on again. We're gonna be back upstairs, so I didn't want to put everything together, and then I forgot until you said you were on your way. So that was fun. Maybe I can get like a government grant to cover all of that, you know, some kind of climate change thing.
I'll pull some strings.
I can apply for. It'd be nice.
We'll mark ourselves as a nonprofit. We're doing this
day. It is definitely a nonprofit.
It's kind of like the whole I declare bankruptcy thing. It's just I declare to be a nonprofit.
I have not made any money.